recording that was found by the estate of journalist W. Thornton Pete Martin. He was a writer for the Saturday Evening Post. And the recording was donated to the Jimmy Stewart Museum. It was recorded on July 11th, 1979, about a month after John Wayne died. This interview is a rebroadcast of a podcast from the Jimmy Stewart Museum website, and the podcast was hosted by Tim Vanderberg. I actually selected this, even though they talk about John Wayne. Jimmy Stewart talks critically about characters, dialogue, motion pictures, and strength. Again, this is from a podcast hosted by Tim Vanderberg from the Jimmy Stewart Museum. It was found by the estate of Pete Martin. I guess he never wrote the article. This was just a preliminary recording leading up to an article because he too would die shortly thereafter. Thanks.
Newspapers brought out big sections, but this is my theory, see what you think of it, that in, without knowing it, maybe we're so sick of a kind of a sick violence, a kind of a nasty violence that we see on television or in real life, that this man's violence is sort of an honest, if you could call it an honest violence, at least it differed from the kind of sick violence, a good word for what I'm trying to talk about, Jimmy, or do you know what I'm trying to say? His is kind of an old-fashioned American-type violence. I'm not doing it very well. You try to... Do you agree with me in any way on this, Jimmy? If so, tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah, I think sick violence as compared to, what do you mean, justifiable violence.
Violence to a good cause, for example. Yeah,
I've read a lot of Western scripts lately, and I've gotten sort of to say a sort of a very short thing in making a sort of an appraisal about the most of them. And I said, the trouble with this is the good guys aren't good enough and the bad guys aren't bad enough. There is a compromising thing with this good guys and the bad guys, which I think is fundamental as a lot of Duke's beliefs and a lot of the beliefs of the good section of our country. They don't want to compromise and say, well, he's all right sometimes. The guy will be mean and nasty, but then he'll change from time to time. This isn't what's meant by the type of thing Duke Wayne was. The good guy was a good guy for this reason, and he was 100% good guy. The bad guy that played opposite him was 100% bad guy. These are the qualities that I think Duke stood for. Now you can say, you know, you don't have to be that straight-laced. Why not?
It's just people forgotten how, that's all. It's not popular anymore. People are not brought up that way, Jimmy, I don't think. You think that's saying it right or not?
Well,
I was brought up that way, by God.
You see this thing so often, and you see it in movies, you see it in plays, you read it in books, and you say, well, it's a new way of thinking about things, and the new permissiveness. Well, this takes care of, in a way, the the good guys being not good enough and the bad guys being not bad enough, there's room to go off on tangents. There's room. Well, this certainly has been accepted to a certain extent. I frankly go along with Duke. I don't think you can fool around with this very much. I mean, you can, the good guy, I don't agree with him saying, well, just this one time this would be all right. Or the bad guy's through and through. I'm after him, and that's what I think, and I'm going to get him. They're qualities, and I suppose it tends to point more and more to discipline, which, as you say, a dirty word, discipline has come to be an uncomfortable word.
Well, to be cornball, isn't it, almost, isn't it?
It's discipline, whether it's voluntary or whether it's imposed. I think you can compare very, very closely with the good guy, bad guy's sentiments. It's a thing that I don't think our country can survive without it.
To me, in my mind, in Duke's acting and his own life, the lines between good and bad were never blurred. They aren't today in so many forms of entertainment and books and television and everything. The lines get kind of blurred. Tell me if I'm wrong. Don't you think in Duke's life and his movies, there wasn't any blurring between good and bad? You knew exactly where one ended and the other left off. Don't you think that's true?
I think it's true. Mm-hmm. I think it's true. And I think also that in the transfer from silent pictures to the talking picture, this was absolutely no problem for Duke, because Duke is a visual man anyway. His strength is visual. It's there for you to see. You don't have to fish around in this character and then say, oh, there is a strength behind that. It's right there, can you see? I think the silent pictures used the medium as a visual medium, which I think is the way it should be used. I think sound came in. Sound was an addition. Sound certainly isn't the basic, one of the basic qualities of the motion picture. Sound is an addition that can be of value.
There was no handicap to him, was it, like it was to some people?
Never was a handicap to him or to John Ford.
Now, that was really a man. I talked to him a lot about Duke when I did a story about him.
Yeah.
Quite a man, John Ford. You think, in a way, Duke is a reflection of his personality and his thinking, John Ford's, or not? Or is it more complicated than that?
I don't think it's complicated. I think they became very dear friends. He became like a son, and I think Duke loved Ford and loved everything about him, and would do anything in the world for him, and was devoted and was. I think this is one of the sort of examples that Duke set up that a lot of people followed, because this idea of an actor and a movie star of Duke's stature being directed by a director who gave him his first job, got him started, there wasn't anything of this Duke the Star shooting way up and leaving the director behind. There was this terrible bond between them and Duke and one of John Ford.
I thought they were very much alike in many ways, those two, don't you? Really?
I think they gave each other things. It was an intertwining that came out of a wonderful sort of a wonderful mixture of things that are very important. I lots of times when you think of all the different tangents that Ford went off on and everything, and in a way some of the ones that Duke went on, but when it comes right down to it, all these tangents were really just a little spin-off, because at the base of all these tangents was this very straight, honest line of integrity, and no one could take that away from them, and no one even tried.
I think one of the simplest things is you can't imagine Duke shooting anybody from behind. He was going to shoot him from right in front and let him know he's getting ready to, give him a chance to fill their hands with a gun.
Yeah.
That was part of his thinking, I think, in movies and life too, don't you, Jimmy?
I think so. There's no... Well, this is a part of the strength. Mm-hmm. This is a part of, and the visual strength. This is with Ford and Wayne, I think it was one of the things that added to them that Wayne was able to give to other people and to other directors. I think it all came from Wayne's integrity that he had before he met Ford, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so that they took and gave. They gave each other some of themselves. And I think the result was an ideal, the ideal way to make a motion picture, and that is using the medium as a visual medium to a bigger extent than any other kind of a medium. Use it as a visual medium and use the components that make a movie, the westerns that he did, but Green Was My Valley, whatever you want, all of them are visual.
Stagecoach, yeah.
All of them are visual.
But in a way, what he had to say fitted in with the visual things that he believed in too. He didn't say much, but what he said was strong too, wasn't it? The strength, like the visual traits too. Don't you think they blended?
That's
Jimmy?
Right. That's right. But what it went back to strength. Mm-hmm. The words were well chosen.
And simple words.
Ford knew a good writer when he had one, and I think Duke recognized good writing. He recognized writing adaptable to the motion picture. If he'd read down these lines and lines of dialogue. I remember a picture, Liberty Valance, that I'll never forget. We had what Ford called a dressing room, a rehearsal room, which was a couple of pieces of canvas and an old table and some. I don't know who he was trying to impress, because he wouldn't let anybody on the set, so I don't know. But we'd get in there, and he'd first say, what scene are we on? Well, somebody would give him the scene, say, well, read this through. So we'd read it through, and he said, everybody's talking too much.
Would you cut down on the words after that?
He said, do it again, and he'd stop somebody, and he'd say, do it, and he'd take that page out, and he'd say, now read it without that.
Just throw it away, you mean, Jimmy?
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
I was there. We took four pages. The scene was maybe 10 pages long. He took four pages out, and it was better. They weren't needed.
Isn't that wonderful? It's a good story, really, isn't it? It's true, I know, too.
I just, personally, with this word thing and this, I remember I did a picture long time ago, and this was when, after the movie Stop Fighting Radio, and sort of used it as an advertisement for their pictures, which turned out to be a very good thing. But they had the Lux Radio Theater. You remember out here that DeMille hosted everything? Well, a lot of the studios would get these. They submit a script and get most of the cast that they could and do it as a radio play with all the effects and everything. Well, I had this picture called Winchester 73.
Oh, I remember it.
And they submitted it, and the play was sent back, and they said, we can't use this play. You'll have to get another, because nobody says anything in this play. And this is an hour program, and we can't fill in the time that the movie takes an action, and so we can't let sound effects of fake horse. We've got to have something. And the thing wasn't put on the air, but for that very reason.
Too many words, you mean, or too little?
There were just in other words, the picture was as far as movies were concerned, it was done right.
They believed in sort of magic of lots of words. Somebody did, I suppose. That would take care of everything. Just words bubbling over words.
That was James Stewart being interviewed by Pete Martin shortly after the death of John Wayne. That was recorded on the 11th of July, 1979. I guess Mr. Martin was getting material for perhaps a story on John Wayne, because John Wayne just died a month prior to that. There's an awful lot of talk of the Duke. I extracted that from the Jimmy Stewart Museum on a podcast hosted by Tim Vanderberg, where essentially he's just, I guess, the estate of Pete Martin found a box of tapes that were exposed to hot and cold. So I listened to the recording on Saturday. It sounded pretty good, but I thought that little section there that I played was kind of suitable for all those Six Shooter fans that the Grand Hour seems to have. Yes, you are listening to the Grand Hour on 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. I'm Arthur. It's the 18th of July, and we had 2 3/10 inches of rain yesterday. That being said, I'm going to go ahead. I wasn't planning on this, but there's a lot of interest in it. So I'm not going to have a double billing today. Like I said, I played that interview. I might try something experimental here in the last segment of the show. But right now, most of you regular listeners will recognize this.
In a moment, you'll hear James Stewart as the Six Shooter, just one of the many fine programs brought to you Sundays on NBC. Later this evening, listen to the NBC Star Playhouse with Leatrice Joy and Jeffrey Lynn. Hear Meet the Press, America's number one news-making program. And be sure to keep tuned for the dramatic story of communism in America on Last Man Out, a wonderful lineup of great programs, all of them heard only on NBC. James Stewart as the Six Shooter. The man in the saddle is angular and long-legged. His skin is sun-dyed brown. The gun in his holster is gray steel and rainbow mother of pearl. Its handle unmarked. People call them both the Six Shooter. The NBC Radio Network presents James Stewart as the Six Shooter, a transcribed series of radio dramas based on the life of Britt Ponsett, the Texas plainsman who wandered through the Western territories, leaving behind a trail of still-remembered legends.
It had snowed during the night, a thick, wet snow that bowed the pine trees and banked over the pink boulders, turning them white. I found myself lying under a good, heavy 6 inches of it when I woke up.
Oh, gee whiz.
Old Scar, he looked like a white-whiskered burro over there, standing beside what was left of the campfire, trying to shake himself dry. All right, take it easy, boy. I'll just wait till I get the fire started again. The wood I'd gathered up the night before was pretty wet, so I got a hand axe out of my pack and I headed over toward a little hill about a quarter of a mile away. Since the wind had been from the north, I figured some of the brush on the far side might still be drying up for burning. Yeah, it wasn't very easy climbing. A couple of times I went in and way over my knees. But the snow was already beginning to melt fast, even though the sun hadn't splashed into the sky yet. And that meant we'd be able to start off in an hour or so. By then, the stuff would be thinned down to mostly mud and water. I hit the crest of the hill and looked around. The south side sliced away at a good sharp angle, and the ground was fairly dry. I spotted a couple of dead oak saplings lying on the ground about 10 feet below me. It seemed likely they'd catch fire without too much trouble. I was kind of surprised to find oaks growing at this altitude. Even so, I... there's some bothering Scar. Probably a jackrabbit or squirrel or something. He sure was making a lot of racket. Wasn't like him to get upset unless... Well, that wasn't a jackrabbit. There's a whole lot more than that. I dropped my axe and I climbed back to the top of the hill as fast as I could climb. The sun was inching over the rim of Spooner Range, and at first the reflection off the snow blinded me. When I got my eyes focused, I saw the fella standing beside Scar, trying to cinch the saddle onto his back.
Hey, you! Hey, let that horse alone!
He looked up, and for a minute he just stood there, as though he didn't know exactly what to do next. Then he jerked the leather tight and he put his foot in the stirrup. Scar wasn't being very helpful, but it didn't keep the fellow from mounting up. I knew I couldn't make it through the snow before they rode off, and I sure didn't like the idea of chancing a shot, not with Scar rearing the way he was. But I didn't have much choice. My first shot was wide, maybe 5-6 feet, and Scar was taking the spur and sort of starting to move in spite of himself, and another minute or two, they'd be out of range. Now, that was a little close, but not close enough. Bullet must have caught the fella high on the leg. He twisted around, tried to get a hold of the pommel, but his fingers slipped off, and I saw him slide into the snow. I couldn't see whether he had a gun or not, but I found out soon enough. I dived behind a clump of pine. There was a clearing between us, and he was using a boulder for cover. Little spray of snow told me I'd chipped the rock right in front of him. I waited for him to answer my fire, but there wasn't a sound from that side. Maybe he was just waiting too, hoping I'd get anxious and come out in the open. Well, I wasn't going to be that obliging. And he still didn't answer. I reloaded my gun. I edged over to the right. If I could just circle without him seeing me, maybe I could come up behind him. About 20 minutes later, I managed to skirt around the clearing. He was up front of me now, just a couple of boulders away. Got up on my haunches and I charged. And then I saw why I'd been so quiet. He was sprawled out face down on the snow, staining it red. It wasn't just his leg that was doing the bleeding, either. There was a bullet hole in the small of his back, and the piece of cloth fastened over it had come loose. His gun was lying beside him, within easy reach. I picked it up. There was still one bullet that hadn't been fired. He started coming to, and I eased him over on his side, and his eyes kind of half opened, and it's just like his lids were too heavy for him to rise all the way.
I stole a lot of things in my time, but I ain't never been a horse thief before.
All right, you better take it easy.
What's the difference? I'm not gonna pull out of this anyhow. I guess I'm lucky. Dying here's a whole lot better than being caught. I always said they'd never hang me. All their rewards, wanted posters, just a waste of time. I told them they'd never hang Ace Tressler.
Tressler?
You heard of me, ain't you?
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard of you.
Everybody's heard of Ace Tressler.
Yeah, one way or another.
Too bad it wasn't your shot that did it, mister. You could collect a mighty fancy reward. About $3,000 it must total up to. And that's not counting yesterday.
Yesterday?
Stage depot. Over to Sunset. Fell in charge. He didn't like the idea of being held up. That's how I got this bullet in my back.
Oh?
But I took care of him. He won't be shooting nobody else.
You killed Sam Fletcher?
I don't know his name, mister. You don't expect a fella to know the names of all the men he shoots, do you?
How'd you get out here without a horse? It's a good 20 miles from Sunset.
I had my pony till just a couple of hours ago. All that snow coming down, he sort of missed his foot. Hurt himself bad.
I'd say.
I sure hated having put him out of his misery. He was a fine horse. Best I have owned. It's a rotten shame. Man having to kill a horse like that.
Yeah.
That's the only reason I tried to take yours. I had to have some kind of mount. There's a posse on my trail. I never stole a horse before, mister. I ain't no horse thief.
Well, you think you can hang on if I heist you onto the saddle?
What for?
Well, you need a doctor. Scar can carry us both.
Only doctors in Sunset.
That's right.
I'd never make it that far. Can't you see I'd never make it that far?
Well, you can try.
No. No, I'm not going back there. We might run into posse along that way.
Yeah, we might.
He'd string me up. Even though there was dying, he'd string me up. And I swore that nobody'd hang me. I swore.
All right, turn over in your face here. I'll put that bandage back.
Listen, mister, you can't let him hang me. I'll be dead anyway. Just a few hours. You can stay here until... And then you can take me back. You can say you done it. Collect a reward for yourself. $3,000, miss.
All right, come on, turn over.
Long as I'm dying anyhow. Let me die out here. Why do you want to give me... James, lynch me.
Nobody's going to lynch you, Tressler.
Give me your word.
Yeah, yeah.
You won't let me down, mister. I swore that you'd never hang East Tressler.
He passed out again, but he was still alive, still hanging on by a thread. I managed to get a couple of makeshift bandages fastened onto him. The bleeding seemed to have let up a little. His leg wasn't hurt too bad. The bullet just sort of went through the flesh, and it didn't look like it had broken anything. But the wound in his back, that was more serious. As far as I could tell, the bullet had just gone all the way into his chest. I picked him up, and I laid him across Scar's back. Then I looped a rope around his body and tried to fix it so that he wouldn't slide around too much. It wasn't going to be a very comfortable ride, but as long as he was unconscious, I wouldn't know it. All right, let's go, boy. Come on. We weren't able to make very good time with Scar carrying both of us through all that slush. It was almost 2 hours later before we came to the main Sunset Trail. And just as we turned on, I spotted the posse. At least what I figured was the posse. Five men loping along toward us from the east. Doc Prince headed the procession. He was the local dentist. And I recognized Ty Barstow and Frosty Ender right behind them. Two boys bringing up the rear. I didn't look familiar. They'd probably moved into Sunset since the last time I was there. Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Well, howdy, Britt.
Hello, Doc.
Well, boys, what'd I tell you? I said he was Britt Ponsett.
Yeah, that's right. Easy, girl. I'm pleased to meet you, Mr. Ponsett. I'm Cliff Slauson, and this here's Harve North.
How are you?
Hi.
Yes, I recognize you the minute you come into sight. I said, there's the six-shooter, I said. And I guess there's nothing the matter with my eyes.
Appears like you're carrying quite a load, Britt. What happened?
It's Art Tressler.
Huh? Tressler?
No.
Well, I'll be doggone.
Let's see here. Yes, it's him, all right. Leastways, it sure looks like them pictures on the posters.
Well, if that don't take the cake...
This neighborhood's getting to be a real outlaw's haven, I reckon.
Well, maybe they'll change their mind about hanging around after they find out what happened today.
Yeah, we've done a pretty good job of taking in the welcome mat.
Pretty good. If you ask me, we set a record. With Ponsett's help, of course.
Boy, you boys didn't need any help from me. You would have found Tressler yourselves for very long.
Well, what are you talking about, Britt? We didn't have the faintest idea he was in these parts.
I'm sure we were already on our way back to town.
You mean you weren't looking for him?
Of course not.
Well, what are you doing out here, then? I thought you were a posse.
We are a posse. But we were hunting George Rabbit.
Rabbit?
Yeah, you remember him, don't you? Robbed Phil Jeffers' general store a couple of years back. Almost killed old man Jeffers.
Yeah, I remember.
Well, sir, he broke out of jail a week ago. The one over to Polk City. And what do you think he did? He headed straight for Sunset and he tried to pull another robbery.
Yeah, only this time he did kill Sam Fletcher while he was at it.
Now, just hold on a minute here, boys. Now, you're trying to tell me that you're looking for George Rabbit and that you think he's responsible for the robbery at the stage depot last night.
Think? We know it, Britt.
Of course we do.
But we ain't looking for him anymore. We found him.
What?
Yeah, just a couple hours ago, hiding in a cabin over by Walnut Creek. That's right, and he won't be pulling no more holdups, neither. We saw to that.
No, boys, now, you better let me explain this, Britt. He might think we was kind of hasty this morning.
Yeah.
It isn't as if we didn't give Rabbit a trial.
A trial?
Well, there was no doubt about his being guilty, Britt. And seeing as how there's no judge in Sunset, and we'd have to wait till next spring for a formal hanging... Well, we sort of speeded things up a mite.
You didn't string him up yourself.
Well, not very high up, just a couple of feet off the ground.
Now, boys, wait just a minute now. Now, Britt, there's no point in your looking so all-fired serious. There's nothing anybody can do about it now.
Well, that's true enough, Doc. Yeah,
There's nothing anybody can do.
We'll return to James Stewart as the six shooter in just a moment. Now, hear this. Within the next 20 seconds, a fire will break out somewhere in the United States. Lives may be lost, property damaged, homes or buildings destroyed. There are 4,600 fires in America every day of the year. They kill 11,000 persons and disfigure or severely burn thousands more. The unfortunate part of this picture is that most of these fires could be avoided. For example, 90% of all fires that start in the home can be traced to human carelessness. By obeying a few simple rules of fire prevention from now on, you and I can protect our homes and our families from this devastating menace. Rule one is, don't smoke in bed or discard lighted cigarettes carelessly. Rule two, go through your house and clean out old newspapers, magazines, and other inflammable debris. Rule three, promptly repair defective wiring as soon as you notice it. Fire won't wait until tomorrow. Rule four, use only those cleaning fluids which will not burn. And last but not least, be careful with matches. Keep them out of the reach of small children. Remember, it doesn't pay to gamble with fire. The odds are against you every time. Now, Act Two of The Six Shooter, starring James Stewart as Britt Ponsett.
Well, I just didn't know what to say. Hayes Tressler hadn't been lying when he told me about robbing the depot and shooting Sam Fletcher. A man doesn't confess to something like that when he thinks he's ready to cash in, you know? And as for George Rabbit, oh, he caused folks trouble ever since he was a kid. He'd been mixed up in all sorts of gunfights, too, fights that usually ended up somebody else dying. But he hadn't killed Sam Fletcher. That's one thing he hadn't done.
Well, looks like Tressler's still with us.
Yeah. Well, I'd better get moving.
Well, you want us to take him into town for you, Britt?
That's a good idea.
No, thanks. You see, I gave him my word that he was going to a medical doctor.
I don't get you.
You see, he was afraid he might be lynched.
But we ain't got no grudge against Tressler, Britt. Oh, I guess he's as mean as they come, but he ain't never given us no bother in Sunset.
Is that so?
I told you. We didn't even know he was in these parts.
I guess you should have known it, Doc.
Huh?
He's the man who shot Sam Fletcher.
What's that? Oh, I know what you're up to, Britt. You're just joshing us. You're trying to make us feel like we've done something wrong and take care of George Rabbit.
Yeah. Well, all I'm saying is that Tressler told me he's held up the stage depot last night and he killed the fellow in charge.
You ain't serious.
I'm about as serious as I can be.
Oh, but, Britt, that don't make sense. Why, it had to be Rabbit.
What made you so sure?
Well, we knew he broke jail. And somebody said they thought they seen him in town yesterday. Now, let me see who. Oh, it was Johnny Silks, I think.
Yeah, and we picked up his trail not far from the depot.
Well, he led right to that cabin on Walnut Creek where we found him.
He admit the robbery and the shooting?
Well, you don't expect a man to admit a thing like that when he knows there's a rope waiting for him.
Yeah. Well, I'll see you.
Oh, no, wait. Now, hold on now, Britt. You're wrong about this. Why, you just gotta be wrong.
You think I'm lying, Doc?
No, of course not, Britt, but everything pointed to Rabbit.
Well, maybe Tressler was just making that up, what he told you.
Well, how did he find out about the robbery, then?
Well, I...
Now, Britt, you know we wouldn't have done anything if we weren't certain in our own minds that we were right. Why, you know that. It's possible we made a mistake. Well, I'm not saying that we did, but it is possible.
No.
Well, even if we did, Rabbit deserved hanging. He's deserved it for a long time.
Yes,
that's what I'm getting at. We didn't do any harm, Britt. Not really.
You didn't, huh?
Oh, of course not. But if you were to tell folks about this, well, they might not see it our way. They might figure that we took too much on ourselves. So you won't say anything, will you?
Well, all I'm doing is taking Tressler into town. Whatever he says after he gets there, that's up to him.
Well, I know,
well,
but
don't
I don't know.
Don't need to worry about Tressler. He ain't going to say nothing.
Huh?
Well, take a look.
Yeah, he was dying. Wasn't any doubt about that. I cut the rope that was holding Montescar's back and carried him over to a dry space just off the trail. And just before I could put him down, he gave a little shudder and I felt the life ease out of his body. Well, he'd been right about one thing. Nobody would ever hang Ace Tressler.
Guess that saves your trip into Sunset, eh, Brett?
Well, I was heading for there anyway, Frosty.
Oh?
As long as I've come this far, I might as well go the rest of the way.
Well, I don't...
Now, look here, Brett. Ace is dead.
Yeah?
Well, then don't you see that there's nobody to say whether he was the one who killed Sam Fletcher or not?
Nobody but Brett.
That's right.
Now, suppose we did go off half-cocked. Suppose we were kind of hasty with Revit. Well, we're sorry about it, but there's nothing we can do for him now.
It seems you told me that before.
Well, it's the truth, ain't it?
Sure.
Well, then what would you gain by getting us into hot water? Letting people know that we kind of overstepped the mark?
Is that what you call it? Overstepping the mark?
Well, it'd be different if Revit was innocent.
Well, somehow I got the idea that he was.
Well, yes, of this robbery, maybe, but,
I had a brother, Ponsett. He'd be alive today if it wasn't for George Revit.
Mm-hmm. Is that why you hung him, to get even for your brother?
No, of course not. We were just doing our duty as citizens. We thought he shot Sam Fletcher.
Well, why are we standing here arguing? If Ponsett wants to try and make trouble, well, he ain't got no proof. It's his word against ours.
That's right. Cliff's right. We can even say that Revit confessed. Why, everybody in Sunset will believe us.
Well, then I don't see what you're so worried about.
Well, we ain't worried, Britt. Not really, of course we're not. I know you pretty well. We've been friends a long time. Why, you're not going to go out of your way to stir up a hornet's nest? No, I'm sure of that.
Well, I ain't so sure. Just a minute, Ponsett. You're not leaving here yet.
Now, Frost.
And boys, it's about time we start using our heads. If he goes into town and spreads this story around, they'll all believe it. Whatever Britt Ponsett says, that's gospel.
But he ain't gonna say anything.
That's right, he ain't. Because he ain't riding into Sunset. He's turning around heading east.
Is that so?
I know you're a fast man on the draw, but there's five of us. You're not that fast.
No, I reckon I'm not.
Now, we don't want to get into any mix-up with Britt Frosty.
What do you want? People to start saying we murdered George Revit?
Murdered?
Well, that ain't what we done at all. His family might not agree with you, Cliff, if they found out the truth about that holdup last night. And he's got a brother, too.
Well, maybe there is something in what Frosty says, but we can't stop Britt. Now, if he takes it upon himself...
We stopped Revit, didn't we?
Frosty?
Put that gun away.
Sure, I'll put it away. After I'm sure that Ponsett's riding east. And I'm warning you, Britt. You ever breathe a word about what Tressler told you?
I don't like being ordered around, Frosty.
Then just keep away from Sunset. Now move. I said...
Well, I held my ground. I knew Frosty Ender pretty well. I knew he wouldn't shoot. His business with Revit had pushed him into deep water, but not that deep. I watched his jaw muscles tighten up, and I saw a little bead of sweat begin to gather between his eyes, and for a minute nobody said anything. And then Ty Barstow shoved forward.
I told you to put it away, Frosty. Wasn't what we already done today bad enough? You want to kill somebody else?
We done nothing wrong. Get that through your skull, Ty. Revit deserved to hang, and we hung him.
What about Britt? Suppose he deserves being shot?
No, not unless he asked for it.
That gun you're holding just proves how wrong we were this morning. If we'd been right, you wouldn't need it.
Shut up.
If we'd been right, we wouldn't be standing here feeling ashamed. Even you feel ashamed. That's why you don't want nobody to hear about it. That's why you're threatening Brady.
Yeah, and I'll make good on that threat, too.
No, you won't. Because we're going into Sunset and tell him what happened. We're going to take our medicine.
You gone, loco.
And it ain't just because Revit didn't kill Sam Fletcher, even if he had. Well, he still wouldn't have been right. Oh, I reckon we wouldn't have found out so quick, but we'd have found out sooner or later.
You know what's the matter with you, Ty? You're yellow. You got a streak a yard wide down your back. You were just as anxious to string up Revit as the rest of us. Things didn't turn out the way you figured.
Yeah, that's true enough.
Hey, yellow, that's what you are, clear through.
You've got the gun, Frosty. You can stop me if you want to. Doc, you coming along?
Yeah.
Cliff, Harv, no kidding.
Sure. Hey, you crazy fools, we didn't do nothing wrong. What's the matter with you? Hey, why can't you see that?
Frosty kept on yelling until they were almost out of sight. Then he turned and shook his head like he couldn't figure out what had happened. I picked up Tressler's body and I laid it across Scar's back. And Frosty swung around and stared at me.
If it hadn't been for you, folks would have said we'd done fine. Nobody would have known about Tressler. Why'd you have to meet up with him today? Why?
Because it snowed last night and his pony stumbled and he needed another horse.
That ain't no reason.
No, maybe not, Frosty. Maybe not. You coming into town?
Yeah.
Let's go.
$50,000 trained nurses are needed now, today. Nurses to serve humanity in hospitals and private duty, in teaching and research, in the Veterans Administration and the Armed Forces. And although a nurse's training means a thorough professional education at far less expense than 4 years of university, it offers a curriculum which includes such fascinating studies as psychology, sociology, and chemistry. And upon graduation, the student becomes a registered nurse and in some schools obtains a Bachelor of Science degree as well. These, then, are the facts of a nursing education. The need has never been greater. The opportunities for a vital, useful career have never been finer. For further information, we suggest that you contact your nearest hospital. The Six Shooter is a transcribed NBC Radio Network production in association with Review Productions. It is based on a character created by Frank Burt and is written by him. Mr. Stewart may currently be seen in the Universal International picture The Glenn Miller Story. Others in the cast were Robert Griffin, Harry Bartell, Lamont Johnson, Howard McNear, and Forrest Lewis. Special music for this program was by Basil Adlam. The entire production is under the direction of Jack Johnstone. All characters and incidents were fictitious, and any resemblance to actual characters or incidents is purely coincidental. Oh, by the way, you'll be interested in knowing that the Six Shooter has been chosen for broadcast to our men overseas through the facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Services. This is John Wall speaking. Tonight, listen to Sunday at Home on the NBC Radio Network.
This is a firearm safety PSA. No matter how you feel about current gun laws, everybody should know the most critical rules about handling any firearm. Rule 0. All guns are always loaded. Rule 1. Never point a gun at anything you are not willing to destroy. Rule 2. Keep your finger off the trigger until your sights are on target and you have made the decision to shoot. Rule 3. Be sure of your target and what is beyond it. A public safety message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio.
Medford. Good morning. You're just tuning in. That was The Trail to Sunset. Original air date of that episode was the 31st of January, 1954. That was not Hal Gibley speaking. He must have taken some time off there. And coming up next here, I follow in the grand hour. Matt at the Whirlpool, I see it looks like he brought some groceries in. You can see through the window here. I'm going to play out Kurt Vonnegut. I found this in the library. My introduction music. The harpsichord concerto, number 5½ minor. I pulled that off of the Slaughterhouse 5 soundtrack. It's a decent book, decent movie, decent soundtrack. But I found this album in the library. Kurt Vonnegut's just kind of I haven't got to the point where he's reading the actual story, but he talks a little bit about the firebombing of Dresden. So I'll play that out until Matt comes on in about 10 minutes. Again, this is Arthur. You're listening to Grand Hour on 91.5 FM, WMFO Medford, WMFO.org. Thanks for listening.
I would hate to tell you what this lousy little book cost me in money and anxiety and time. When I got home from the Second World War 23 years ago, I thought it would be easy for me to write about the destruction of Dresden, since all I would have to do would be to report what I had seen. And I thought, too, that it would be a masterpiece, or at least make me a lot of money, since the subject was so big. But not many words about Dresden came from my mind then, not enough of them to make a book anyway. And not many words come now, either, when I've become an old fart with his memories and his Pall Malls, with his sons and daughters full grown. I think of how useless the Dresden part of my memory has been, and yet how tempting Dresden has been to write about, and I am reminded of the famous limerick. There was a young man from Stamboul who soliloquized thus to his tool. You took all my wealth and you ruined my health, and now you won't pee, you old fool. And I'm reminded, too, of the song that goes, my name is Jan Janssen, I work in Wisconsin, I work in a lumber mill there. The people I meet when I walk down the street, they say, what's your name? And I say, my name is Jan Janssen, I work in Wisconsin, and so on, to infinity. Over the years, people I've met have often asked me what I'm working on. I've usually replied that the main thing was a book about Dresden. And I said that to Harrison Starr, the movie maker, one time, and he raised his eyebrows and inquired, is it an anti-war book? Yes, I said, I guess. You know what I say to people when I hear they're writing anti-war books? No, what do you say, Harrison Starr? I say, why don't you write an anti-glacier book instead? What he meant, of course, was that there would always be wars and that they were as easy to stop as glaciers. I believe that, too. And even if wars didn't keep coming like glaciers, there would still be plain old death. When I was somewhat younger, working on my famous Dresden book, I asked an old war buddy named Bernard V. O'Hare if I could come to see him. He was a district attorney in Pennsylvania. I was a writer on Cape Cod. We had been privates in the war, infantry scouts. We had never expected to make any money after the war, but we were doing quite well. I had the Bell Telephone Company find him for me. They are wonderful that way. I have this disease late at night sometimes, involving alcohol and the telephone. I get drunk and I drive my wife away with a breath like mustard gas and roses. And then, speaking gravely and elegantly into the telephone, I ask the telephone operators to connect me with this friend or that one, from whom I have not heard in years. I got O'Hare on the line this way. He is short and I am tall. We were Mutt and Jeff in the war. We were captured together in the war. I told him who I was on the telephone. He had no trouble believing it. He was up. He was reading. Everybody else in his house was asleep. Listen, I said, I'm writing this book about Dresden. I'd like some help remembering stuff. I wonder if I could come down and see you and we could drink and talk and remember. He was unenthusiastic. He said he couldn't remember much. He told me, though, to come ahead. I think the climax of the book will be the execution of poor old Edgar Derby, I said. The irony is so great. A whole city gets burned down and thousands of people are killed. And then this one American foot soldier is arrested in the ruins for taking a teapot. And he's given a regular trial and then he's shot by a firing squad. Uh-huh, said O'Hare. Don't you think that's really where the climax should come, I said. I don't know anything about it, he said. That's your trade, not mine. I think about my education sometimes. I went to the University of Chicago for a while after the Second World War. I was a student in the Department of Anthropology. At that time, they were teaching that there was absolutely no difference between anybody. They may be teaching that still. Another thing they taught us was that nobody was ridiculous or bad or disgusting. Shortly before my father died, he said to me, "You know, you never wrote a story with a villain in it." I told him that was one of the things I learned in college after the war. Even then, I was supposedly writing a book about Dresden. It wasn't a famous air raid back then, in America anyway. Not many Americans knew how much worse it had been than Hiroshima, for instance. I didn't know that either. There hadn't been much publicity. I wrote the Air Force back then, asking for details about the raid on Dresden. Who ordered it? How many planes did it? Why they did it? What desirable results there had been, and so on. I was answered by a man who, like myself, was in public relations. He said that he was sorry, but that the information was top secret still. I read the letter out loud to my wife, and I said, "Secret? My God, from whom?" We were United World Federalists back then. I don't know what we are now. Telephoners, I guess. We telephone a lot, or I do anyway, late at night. I taught creative writing in the famous Writer's Workshop at the University of Iowa for a couple of years after that. I got into some perfectly beautiful trouble, got out of it again. I taught in the afternoons. In the mornings I wrote. I was not to be disturbed. I was working on my famous book about Dresden. And somewhere in there, a nice man named Seymour Lawrence gave me a 3-book contract. And I said, "Okay, the first of the 3 will be my famous book about Dresden." The friends of Seymour Lawrence call him Sam. And I say to Sam now, "Sam, here's the book." It is so short and jumbled and jangled, Sam, because there is nothing intelligent to say about a massacre. Everybody is supposed to be dead, to never say anything or want anything ever again. Everything is supposed to be very quiet after a massacre, and it always is, except for the birds. And what do the birds say? All there is to say about a massacre. Things like pootie-weet. I have told my sons that they are not, under any circumstances, to take part in massacres, and that the news of massacres of enemies is not to fill them with satisfaction or glee. I have also told them not to work for companies which make massacre machinery, and to express contempt for people who think we need machinery like that. I looked through a Gideon Bible one time for tales of great destruction. "The sun was risen upon the earth when Lot entered unto Zoar," I read. "Then the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew these cities, and all the plain, and all the inhabitants of the cities, and that which grew upon the ground." So it goes. Those were vile people in both those cities, as is well known. The world was better off without them. And Lot's wife, of course, was told not to look back where all those people and their homes had been. But she did look back, and I'd love her for that, because it was so human. So she was turned to a pillar of salt. So it goes. People aren't supposed to look back. I'm certainly not going to do it anymore. I've finished my war book now. The next one I write is going to be fun. This one is a failure, and it had to be, since it was written by a pillar of salt. It begins like this. Listen. Billy...
91.5 WMFO Medford.